Yeah. All right. So you list in the, I think is the introduction, three questions. And then in chapter two, there's seven more questions. So I'm just going to rattle these off. So these are questions that you hint at, hoping to answer throughout the work. So should Christians do work differently than unbelieving colleagues? Is faith work integration different when you are working in the public versus private sector? And certainly, like, you know, church state issues there. Number three, should we promote distinctively Christian public policies? That's an interesting one. And then questions from chapter two, how should Christians understand their role in government, the role of government and their role in it? Should our work look different than our unbelieving coworkers? Should we favor Christianity somehow? Should we seek to evangelize our coworkers or the people that we serve? Should we subvert policies that we believe are anti-Christian? Should we work toward a Christian society? And how can Christian beliefs make us better coworkers and public servants? Well, on this episode of Grace at the Gates, I have just a great topic that really fits the title and theme of this podcast. We're going to call it Bureaucrats. I knew I was going to mispronounce that. Bureaucrats in Babylon. This is a book written by Professor Christopher Horn. Do I call you Chris? Chris. Okay. And man, he's got a resume. So I'm going to just read this just to give you a sense of who we're talking to. Christopher S. Horn is the Dalton Roberts Professor of Public Administration at University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, where he serves as Political Science and Public Service Department Head and teaches in the Master of Public Administration program. He has a PhD in Public Policy from Georgia Tech and Georgia State University's Joint Program, a Master of Arts in Biblical and Theological Studies from Belhaven University, a Master of Science in Social Work from University of Tennessee at Knoxville, and a Bachelor of Arts in Sociology from Berry College. He's written in a number of journals. He has a few books, but the one we are talking about now is called Bureaucrats in Babylon. I'm going to try to share it, Chris.
Well,
hold it up. There it is. That's even better. You married? Do you have kids, grandkids?
Yeah.
What's your family situation?
So, I am married to Sally. I'm actually sitting at her desk because she has a better setup than me. We will have been married for 30 years this coming May. So, yeah, it's a big one. Thank you. And we have four kids. They are adults and near adults. They're 23, 21, 19, and 17. And I just acquired a daughter-in-law.
Awesome.
about a month ago. So, really thrilled by that. And so one step closer to being a granddad, but not there yet.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm, delighted that you would find it interesting to talk about this.
Well, you reached out to me and I not a lot of people reach out to me, but I get people every week that'll reach out to me and often they're authors. And, you know, I always say, all right, I'll look into it. But obviously your book and your topic, it was related to a lot of, not just what I've been doing on this podcast, but what I do in ministry as ministry to state, wearing my swag there, the state capital minister to Florida, where I seek to minister to bureaucrats in Babylon. And so it took me a while. I started reading this. It's not a long book. I got to tell you, I really thought it was going to be more devotional and more fluff. Honestly, it wasn't. It was awesome. And, I thought, you know, I knew everything. I was like, yeah, I know he's going to write about this and that. No, it was phenomenal. You had data and research in there. I can tell you're into research methods and statistics. You actually spoke with a number of public administrators across the country. And I really liked a lot of your categorization of how different Christian public administrators view their role, their faith work integration. And there's a spectrum there. And that really fits well with what I've been doing as I've been uncovering some of these Christian nationalist beliefs, you know, in the Reformed world. And, you know, there's always a spectrum, and it's just interesting on how you did that. And so I want to say, and I've already told you this offline, I'm going to be buying a bunch of these and giving them out as I minister in the state capitol, because it's just a great blessing and gift, I think, to give to people who really use their role in government as a, or view it as a calling. So, yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah. That's really my hope in writing it, that, it would get into the hands of people who would find it helpful. So really appreciate that.
Yeah. No, and I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it. Again, I thought it was going to be kind of more fluff, you know, but for a 90 page book, it was really, impactful. And I think, listeners, especially listeners who are interested in, government and government people and things of government, this will interest you. And what I'll say is, I've only been doing this for a month now, actually daily in the state capitol, meeting elected officials and government workers. And man, so many of them, every single one I've met truly cares about what they're doing, whether they're Christian or not. You know, yep. The word bureaucrat gets it's kind of a pejorative now. You know, I actually bristled right. under your title a little bit,
yeah.
Because like and the way politics is perceived and viewed in the media and in the news, and there's this sliminess to it. And no, these people are very vulnerable. They're very passionate about what they believe in. And I've just been really touched and impressed as I've tried to minister to them. And I think your book kind of reveals that, which was neat.
Yeah. And your experience is consistent with a lot of research about bureaucrats, about public administrators, that most people will have a negative connotation associated with bureaucrats, with government workers, except when you actually meet them. So if we ask people, you know, what was your experience like the last time that you interacted with someone working for government, then it's almost always a positive experience. And also there's a lot of research about public administrators' motivations, and there really is a genuine public service ethos in the profession. So I'm glad you've seen that firsthand. And I am trying to sort of rescue the word bureaucrat a little bit. I've done that in my teaching a lot, where I've told my students, you know, you're going to be a bureaucrat. It's not a dirty word. You know, the problems that we have with bureaucracy aren't bureaucracy. It's bureaucratic pathologies when bureaucracy goes poorly. I once taught a class called Beautiful Bureaucracy, talking about the benefits of bureaucratic forms, but also I just really like the alliteration of bureaucrats in Babylon. So I think about half the reason I chose the title was I'm fond of the alliteration.
Yeah, well, even Babylon gets, Babylon is not viewed positively
right.
In scripture. So you have almost a double negative occurring, but not. And it's, what does the word bureaucrat mean and bureaucracy mean? Like, do you know the etymology of it or the roots of it, or just like what is the general definition of a bureaucrat?
You know, I don't know the etymology, I'm using the term, as most do, pretty much interchangeably with public administrator. So a public administrator is someone who's in a management role in a government agency. There are broader definitions of public administration than that. But, you know, to include folks in nonprofit organizations who might have a hand in implementing public policies, and even in the private for-profit sector. But the narrow and kind of cleanest definition would be managers and other leaders, administrators in public agencies.
Okay. So this doesn't, like, does the term does not include politicians, or does?
Yeah, it doesn't include elected officials. And you know, and that gets a little bit to why I wrote the book. There are a lot of books out there about integrating faith and work in general. We don't really need more of those. And there are a lot of books about political theology. And I you know, that's not where I'm going to make my big contribution. But as far as I could tell, there's no one who's written specifically for this audience, for a Christian public administrator. And so I try to have a pretty narrow focus on that niche of public administrators. That said, this is not a small group of people. We're talking about something like 20 million employees in all the levels of government just in the United States. And about half of those profess to be Christians, and at least a fifth of those profess to be Christians who attend church regularly.
Yeah.
So it's not just a few people. Yeah.
Yeah, I found those statistics fascinating in the book. I will say, like, you're right, there is a lot on political theology now, and that was another reason I was kind of skeptical about what this book was going to be, because what I find is quite often practitioners in government aren't up on the political theology, and that's why they look down on it. It's like, we're the ones doing this job, and you guys are talking about magistrates and God, you know. but I mean, there is a stream of tradition and history and biblical understanding around political theology, and I was just wondering if you were going to be conversant with it. I found you extremely conversant with it. I didn't find any real flaws in any of your thinking or reasoning. You drew on Kuiper, even Van Druden, who's, you know, again, modern Two Kingdom guy that I don't necessarily agree with. But you talk about the law of God. You bring in Aquinas's three categories, which honestly I haven't been that familiar with. Obviously, I know about the three uses of the laws and the three types of laws in Scripture, but I loved Aquinas's levels and layers of law. You talk about theonomy, the difference between general equity theonomy and reconstructionist theonomy. And my point in saying this is because a lot of my listeners obviously are pastors and people in NAPARC or PCA and familiar with the discussions we've been having on political theology. And your, again, short work is very conversant with it, although that's not... So I think what I like what you did is you didn't like... get into it that much, the political theology side of it, but you're showing you're aware of it. And you also are really not taking a side in the conversation as much as it seemed to me like you were taking very much a view of prudence, you know, time and place. Yeah. So maybe speak to that.
Well, lots of reactions there. So in writing the book, what is now Chapter 2 is what you referred to, the study I did. So this was talking to Christian public administrators around the country about their ideas of how they relate their faith to their work. And in doing that, something that came really clear to me was that if I were to follow this up with the book, as I now have, I wanted it to be a doctrine first book, because I thought that's what would be most helpful to these folks. I loved talking to these public administrators, there was a lot of wisdom in that group. But I think that where I can help is by giving them some doctrinal foundations. And so the book is intended to be kind of a doctrine first, building doctrine, or drawing on doctrine inductively from Scripture, as opposed to starting with, you know, theologians and systems of theology that have been handed down. And plus, that's just not what I'm equipped to do personally. This is not a retrieval project. So I do draw on some of those sources and find them really helpful. Put them in conversation with each other just a little bit. You mentioned Van Druden, but, you know, Van Druden in a conversation with some of his critics as well.
Right.
And it's kind of get to the punchline. You know, I remember early on in my own career and just outside of my career, really sometimes getting kind of frustrated with the Bible. It didn't give me this really tidy list of, you know, here's what makes for a good polity, and here's what makes for a bad polity. Here's good policy, here's bad policy. Mm. And if here's a form of government, Scripture does not give us that level of detail that we might long for. And I found that kind of frustrating sometimes. But what I've come to learn is that God is continuing to invite us into that work of moving his creation forward and serving as his sub-regents, engaging in wisdom and creativity as we continue the work of subduing the creation. And he invites us into exercising our discretion, our creativity, and growing in wisdom, as opposed to just handing us all the answers. And that is, I find great comfort in that, that God has given us such dignity and is really humbling. I love the story. So I didn't put this in the book because you can tell me if you think this is a little bit going too far, but I love it, just the first pages of the Bible where God is asking, has just given the creation a mandate, subdue the creation, bring order to my creation, make the most of it. And then he brings Adam these animals to name. And I mean, this is before the fall, so I'm sure Adam had just the right response to this. But my response would have been, who, me? Like, God, you're right here. Maybe you should do that. I think you would be better at this. But it's such a this nice imagery of God bringing the animals to Adam and having him do the work of naming them. And I think, it's there included in the creation story, I think, for a reason. And, is it teaching us that God is expecting us to exercise this wisdom and creativity, and he's not handing us the easy answers, but wants us to engage in that work. And I think those same lessons still apply today.
No, that's awesome. No, you're totally on point there. And I've done like I'm in a doctoral program at Birmingham Theological Seminary. I've been on stall doing my doctor ministry there, but that'll feature that aspect of the creation story in conjunction with the cultural mandate to subdue and exercise dominion. I mean, that's God showing Adam what he means. There's, there is a sort of a playfulness about that, and there's a sweetness. Like I my first child is Adam, and I remember sitting with him, he's in college now, like on my lap with, what kind of book open, but children's books about animals where he's naming the animals. Like, it's like and there is that sense, but it's more than that, obviously, with God and the first Adam there, because it's not simple naming. It's there's classification there. There's
Right.
intelligent sort of, well, that one looks silly. I'll call that one a platypus.
And how do these different animals go together, and what are the characteristics that are important that I have to consider? We're still engaging in that kind of work, that bringing order to God's creation and making the most of it. And government employees, I think, have a God-ordained role in that.
So one interesting thing that occurred to me, and I'm always looking for like narrative arcs and just how like microcosms and macrocosms and stuff like this. And what I realized is this book is kind of like life imitating art or art imitating life, because you're not a public administrator, but you're a professor in a secular college.
Yeah, and I would say I am a public administrator.
Okay, tell me about it.
I've moved into an administrative role. For 7 years, I was the director of our graduate program, but now I'm department head, and so it's more of an administrative role than a traditional professor role. And that shift in my career definitely, encouraged me to write the book. Writing this book was kind of a 90-degree turn in terms of my research agenda. This is not something that I've been doing for a very long time, but just for a few years now. It has been very helpful to see it through the lens of my own work and reflecting on my own experience as being an administrator in a public institution.
Well, I mean, that's what I, so here you are in a public institution secular, and you're integrating your faith with your work through a book that I don't know. Do you sign this to your students? Are you allowed to?
No, and I wouldn't. I think that would be imprudent. Particularly, I do engage in a bit of, outright proselytizing in the preface.
Very grateful for that, by the way, and at the end.
But I have, though, shared it with students. You know, when I have conversations with students, they know that I'm a believer. It comes up. I bring it up. I connect with lots of Christian students. They're aware of the book. You know, it's something that my university is very supportive of, and I've given away multiple copies of the book to students who are interested, and it's led to some really fun conversations with them.
Great, great. So let's get into it a little bit. One quote I actually tweeted. Are you on X? Are you on Twitter?
Infrequently, but occasionally. I find it very easy not to be addicted to Twitter.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you. But I couldn't find you. Actually, we didn't go into this, and I don't want to take too much time on this, but you are in the PCA, correct?
I am. Yeah. Okay. I'm
so tell people where you worship and your
yes, sir. So I am a member at Lookout Mountain Presbyterian Church, which I could almost see through the woods here. It's just a couple of blocks up the street. So I've been in the PCA again since 2018. Prior to that, I was in the OPC for 12 years.
Okay.
There's a small OPC church that I was very active in here at Chattanooga. But we moved to Lookout and eventually moved our membership up here. So teach first grade Sunday school, occasionally play the piano or sing in the choir, but really, you know, loved the small OPC church, loved the large PCA church. Prior to that, I had been at Westminster Presbyterian in Atlanta for 6 years, and a second Presbyterian, the EPC church in Memphis, when we lived in Memphis for 4 years. So I've from EPC, PCA, OPC, I've covered the gamut of this small little corner of.
Well, and you went to Belhaven, and Belhaven is, you know, great. Yeah. There's a lot of ties there in Jackson.
Yeah. And then that was online. So I've never set foot on the campus.
Okay.
But yeah, strong PCA connections there at Belhaven that I benefited from a great deal.
How'd you learn of this podcast to reach out to me?
So to be
honest, I got attacked. Somebody was attacking me for something, and you're saying.
No, not at all. When I reached out to you, it was actually in your role as with the Ministry to State. Oh. I emailed you and several of your colleagues, and I've emailed, you know, professors of public administration at Christian universities across the country, just letting them know about the book. And so really wasn't angling to get on the podcast.
All right. So you list in the, I think is the introduction, three questions. And then in chapter two, there's seven more questions. So I'm just going to rattle these off. So these are questions that you hint at, hoping to answer throughout the work. Should Christians do work differently than unbelieving colleagues? Is faith work integration different when you are working in the public versus private sector? And certainly, like, you know, church state issues there. Number three, should we promote distinctively Christian public policies? That's an interesting one. And then questions from chapter two, how should Christians understand their role in government, the role of government and their role in it? Should our work look different than our unbelieving coworkers? Should we favor Christianity somehow? Should we seek to evangelize our coworkers or the people that we serve? Should we subvert policies that we believe are anti-Christian? Should we work toward a Christian society? And how can Christian beliefs make us better co-workers and public servants? And I thought every one of those questions is so relevant to, you know, again, conversations today. Very relevant. Now, did you find these questions were on the mind of the people you interviewed for the study in chapter two?
Yeah, definitely. either sometimes explicitly or implicitly. So to talk a little bit about the study, it was a qualitative study, so you need to be careful about, you know, what you can and cannot learn from qualitative work. But the goal was to build a good description and some explanation for how Christian public administrators think about the integration of their faith and work. And as you alluded to earlier, you know, what I found was, of course, as you'd expect, a wide range. And I think these are, and they're all valid. But for some people, it was very, their faith work integration is very internal, like just really kind of inside their own heads. Where they, for others, it was more interpersonal. So their relationships with coworkers, particularly. And then with others, it was more public facing. And all those public administrators had different questions that grappled with different challenges to those types of faith work integration that resulted in this taxonomy. It's every social scientist dream is to develop a taxonomy. So I finally got mine.
And it was super helpful. Is this the Pius integration versus instrumental?
Yeah, and so then you also have another type of variation among faith work integration was between those who saw, who see their work as a context for developing their own personal piety, for fulfilling their duties to God. And so, you know, in exercising and growing in their personal piety, cultivating virtues, seeing their work as a vehicle for spiritual fulfillment, as opposed to those who exercise or pursue what I call instrumental integration, where they see their faith as a resource for doing their work. And so in fulfilling their professional duties, they draw on their faith in making better decisions and behaving with integrity and building work teams that are more effective, and even in crafting public policies that they think are good for people, are good for social flourishing.
I found it helpful. I was an engineer, so taxonomies make sense to me. You also talked about, you know, where somebody might end up on this spectrum between like Pius integration and instrumental integration has to do with how people navigate the sacred secular divide.
So all models oversimplify. And so please know that, you know, I'm very aware this is oversimplifying, but for those who gravitate towards more of a sacred secular divide, then they also tend to gravitate towards more of the Pius integration, where they see their experience at work as, you know, God providing a context for their own sanctification, for fulfilling their Christian duties. But those who have a more holistic Christian worldview are those who then tend to pursue more of the instrumental integration, where they see their faith as a resource for doing their job as a public administrator well. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of why do people vary in terms of the context of their integration, whether that's just internal as an individual or in the workplace or with regard to society, that seems to hinge on their perception of religious liberty, of how much do they perceive that they have the liberty to exercise the religion. And those who perceive very low, you know, lots of constraints on their religious liberty, then, as you'd expect, tend to emphasize more the internal kind of keeping their faith work integration in their own brains, whereas those who perceive broader religious liberty tend to gravitate more toward the external, seeing their workplace and society as a whole as the context for integrating their faith in their work.
Yeah, I like that, and I liked how you said perceived.
That's what's important, because it's and there's previous research about this, about how in the U.S. context, and so of course this is extremely context dependent, but in the United States, public administrators tend to really underestimate their religious liberty, They think that there are more constraints on them than there really are. But what is ultimately important are their perceptions. And so, you know, one maybe contribution of the book is to raise some awareness about exactly what are the contours of that of religious liberty for public administrators in the United States.
Yeah. Well, one thing I talk about when I talk about the civil use of the law with people I'm discipling or teaching on it. So, you know, the moral use, the civil use, the pedagogical use is, you know, the law's role in restraining evil in society is not simply legislated law. It's also social capital and stigma attached to law.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
while, you know, like in our country, we do have freedom. And I want you to talk about the Clinton Doctrine in a minute that you brought up, because I was unaware of that. And I found that fascinating. But depending on the state you're in, there you could lose or gain social capital based on your own public religious expression. So here in Florida, everybody's a Christian, they let you know. And I don't mean in the state, I mean in the yeah. government. But I have colleagues that work in states and nobody mentions their faith.
Yeah, you know, that's something I really pushed into some, because it came up in these interviews. As you said, people, these public administrators were both thinking about legal constraints, but also just the norms where they are geographically. So something I pushed into some, something that was so interesting to me was, I found, this is just two examples, but in one example, it was two men who work literally in the same building. Their description of their context was completely different, completely opposite. I didn't actually ask them this, but they both just kind of volunteered estimates of how many of their coworkers are believers. And it was just wildly different. Corresponding to that were their reactions in terms of, you know, how free they felt to bring up their faith in the workplace. And then the other example were two public administrators who work in DC. And again, just had such different descriptions of their shared context. And so it really underscores the importance of the perception versus reality. And maybe it's a good exercise to think through, you know, let me check my perceptions against reality. So you mentioned the Clinton guidelines, which is something that I was unaware of before I was diving into this as well. And I also found it fascinating. So 1997, the Justice Department issued these guidelines for religious expression in the federal workplace, but then that gets applied very broadly. So this is 1997, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, discussions about the role of religion and government was just kind of in the air. This was in the wake of welfare reform, which included charitable choice provisions, so that really opened up the opportunity for faith-based organizations to be involved in delivering social services that were funded by the government. I think because it was so much sort of in the air that people were asking questions about, well, you know, exactly like, what can we do? What can we not do? So this document that's come to be known as the Clinton Guidelines, it sounds, my students would say that sounds very old, you know, in the last century, the late 1900s. But they've been referred to more recently. So they're still drawn on in government regulations, and I cite some of that in the book. So they're still relevant. They still seem to be the best guidance that we have. And the take home from that document is that religious speech is protected to the same degree that other speeches in the government workplace. So, you know, just as you can discuss, you know, your favorite football team over the water cooler, you can also discuss Sunday's sermon over the water cooler. There are limits. We have and those limits, actually these freedoms and these limits all reflect just our constitutional context, that we have religious freedoms built into the Constitution, but we also, as government employees, I can't be seen as doing anything to establish religion. So any speech that could be interpreted as establishing a state religion obviously is prohibited, but also there's prudence, and so it's also prohibited to continue any sort of religious speech if you've been asked to knock it off. Like if someone finds it, if they don't want that to be a part of their workplace, or if it's impinging on just workplace efficiency. But that's the same for any other kind of speech. And so the guidelines really spell out for us what we already know from the Constitution, and is that there are very broad protections for religious speech in the government workplace.
So are they, these Clinton guidelines are not law, right? I mean, they're not like the Supreme Court hasn't said, yes, these are, these are okay according to our law, or they have.
So no, as far as I know, and there I don't want to speak beyond what I've looked into. And they're not even regulations, so you're right that they don't carry the weight of law, but they are the, as far as I can tell, the most explicit and most valuable guidance from the Justice Department. And so I think they're a reliable standard for sure.
Yeah, I mean, they do. They definitely seem to interpret the law the right way. I mean, like you said, I mean, people get very. And I used to say this even when I was in high school to people. Like, you could talk about your favorite football team or about cars with passion or anything else, and that's like normal. But if you talk about faith, religion, scripture, like that somehow crosses a boundary. And so it's interesting that this is Clinton. Of course, I always said Clinton's one of the best Republican presidents we've had.
In
But
retrospect, it starts to look that way now.
I know. Okay, so just some comments I liked. This is, I think this is the one I tweeted. Our identity in Christ can't be left behind when we step through the doors of our government workplaces. His grip is too firm and his salvation too transforming. Christian public administrators may disagree over how faith should affect our work, but not whether. And I think that's just a great exhortation, observation, all of it.
Yeah, and it really came through in those interviews as well that even those who struggle to really articulate how they integrate their faith in their work or how they would aspire to, no one questioned whether their faith should affect their work in some way.
Yeah. Okay. Here's some. So, chapter one is where you establish some of those theological things you mentioned before, and you really use Daniel's life, and obviously, like Daniel's the most full expression or full like narrative we have of a Christian, of a not Christian, but Christian. You know what I mean? Biblical public administrator. Nehemiah would be also. But so here's some quotes from that. All that follows is intended to help Christian public administrators consider how to emulate Daniel's example, seeking the welfare of our society where we find ourselves sojourning until Christ returns, while never compromising our faith and making the most of opportunities for Christian witness. Another one, we might have expected Daniel to undertake acts of sabotage, seeking revenge or righteous judgment, but no, Daniel pursued excellence as a Babylonian bureaucrat. Throughout his decades of service, Daniel was serving idol-worshipping governments alongside sorcerers and astrologers. He had more insight into the true God, into God's providence over these pagan kings and kingdoms than anyone else. Yet he continued to serve them while trusting God to work out his purposes. Daniel did not, though, serve the pagan kings indiscriminately, nor did he, quote, keep his faith out of the office. I'll just keep a couple more. Daniel told Darius he had been found blameless before God, both God and the king. Yes, he had broken Darius's law, but he had not broken any of God-ordained law and was therefore blameless before Darius. Daniel served pagan governments wholeheartedly, but was always mindful that their authority came from God and could be legitimately exercised only within the boundaries of his law. And that'll speak to a lot of, a lot of the current Christian concerns over how God's law applies in these cases. One point you made about Daniel that I thought was I hadn't considered before, but you had a few scriptures where Daniel was in real emotional trial himself personally, anguish. And yet, yeah. Then, you know, he would get up from that anguish, and it says, and he was about the king's business.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite verses to run across. You're reading, I love the story of Daniel, and reading through the first, I forget, like, you know, 9-10 chapters with these questions in mind was just a lot of fun. And I do love that line where he has these, you know, these sweeping visions. And of course, that's what we mostly think about when we think about Daniel and what we learn from him, and I think rightly so. But you know, so God's given him these sweeping visions, and it makes him sick. So the poor guy is sick, it says, for several days. But then when he gets better, it says he hops back up and he gets back to the king's work. And in another case, in an earlier vision, he gets this vision and he keeps it to himself and he gets back to the king's work. And so, you know, I think rightly think of Daniel in terms of his prophecies, and the message that God was sending his people through Daniel. That's the sermon that I want to hear on Sunday morning. But for the public administrator to read the Daniel narrative and to see that, like, he had a day job, right? Like, most of the time he was administering these kingdoms. And we do have to be careful about, you know, in these Old Testament narratives, what is descriptive, what is normative. But I do think it's very safe to take Daniel as a normative example. You know, Gabriel tells him he's been loved by God. In the Daniel narrative, we're never told anything wrong that Daniel does. He's presented as, I think, an example for us. And he's an example for all Christians. But he is so particularly an example for public administrators who are Christians and trying to grapple with these questions. So he serves with excellence. He, like us, he's working in a pagan kingdom. You know, he's serving in not a Christian regime, obviously, but as are we. But he does it with excellence. And we know this because he keeps getting promoted. And he survives, works through multiple regimes. He gets his last promotion from Belshazzar on the night that then Belshazzar dies. It is, you know, they're taken over. But Daniel rises again, and he's recognized for his excellence again and again. So he's clearly serving in his government role very effectively. And we have a little hint that he read Jeremiah's letter. So Jeremiah, I think it was 7 or 8 years after Daniel was taken to Babylon, he writes his letter to the Babylonian exiles, where Jeremiah 29 famously encourages them to, you know, put down roots, to get married, have babies, grow gardens, seek the welfare of this place where you are, because that's where you're going to find your welfare. Later in Daniel, he references the Jeremiah letter. It makes you think that he must have been aware of it. It's possible that he was the original recipient, but we don't know for sure. But he certainly acts like it. You know, if he didn't read that line, he certainly acts like it, that he's seeking the welfare of the place where he is. He's serving there with excellence. But that is not without limit. And we see, you know, the stories that I teach my first grade Sunday school class, that we remember where Daniel did obey God rather than man, even when faced with really dire consequences, along with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, is that their names? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, where they all knew that they could serve in that role with excellence until they were asked to violate God's law. And that's where they drew the line and put their faith in God. And, you know, we're not going to find better guidance than that for ourselves.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you think of Daniel, you know, why he gets thrown in the lion's den for praying at the window when you know, his colleagues make that law that that would forbid that. What I find interesting about that is there's no law in the Bible that says that the Jewish people must open their window and pray at the window, you know. And so why I bring that up is because you kind of hear this idea that we are supposed to, Romans 13, we're supposed to do everything the government says we're to do unless it, unless they command us to sin or tell us to do something against God's law. And I just don't see, I think that Daniel example is an example of beyond that, because Daniel could have just closed the window and prayed. He wasn't prohibited. They would have never known that. But like, the government had overstepped their God-given bounds in that. And Daniel, so, but I could hear Christians today basically saying that. Well, okay, you got to just do it with your blinds closed then. You
know? Yeah.
It's like,
yeah, I wonder, so there's a couple of passages that make it clear that Daniel's coworkers were very, and his boss, the king, they were very aware of his faith. You know, the king refers to him, Nebuchadnezzar, and I think also Darius refers to him as, you know, describes Daniel as always worshiping your God and always serve your God whom you always serve. And his coworkers describe him as similarly. And so it's just really clear that Daniel had not hidden his faith. They were very aware of that he served Jehovah. And, you know, with the window thing, I don't know, but, you know, did they... It seems they made a special effort to, you know, they were trying to trap him. And he carried about his, what he thought was his duty. It's a great example.
Yeah. And so, you know, you referenced Jeremiah 29, you know, build houses, plant gardens, get married, give your children in marriage, seek the welfare of the city, for and as it prospers, so will you. Big theme verse for me in ministry to state is the New Testament companion to that, to pray for our leaders, paraphrase, that you may lead peaceful and quiet lives, godly and dignified in every way.
Yes.
And then I love, and by the way, I love how you handled this in the book, and because the Lord wants all people to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. And you really kind of combine the common grace and servants in service of saving grace thing there, which I thought was great. Very Kuyperian, by the way. And
Bavinckian, if that's a word, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah. The Dutch Reformed side of things for sure. So anyway, appreciated that.
And that's, I mean, if there's this obviously is an original contribution, but something, a bit of doctrine that I would want Christian public administrators to take away from this book is that they are agents of God's common grace. And that is by God's design, that one way that he has designed the world is that there are governments, and that governments are one way that he takes care of his creation. And public administrators are playing a role in that. And there's, you know, example after example of that, and obviously a theme I really develop in the book. But then... that's awesome. And I would, as a public administrator, as a Christian public administrator, I just find that to be really humbling and encouraging. And that's something that I would really want readers to take away, but it gets even better. And it is because common grace serves redeeming grace. If I'm going to, in 1 Timothy 2, there's another passage, 1 Timothy 2, where Paul is instructing us to pray for our government officials. And he starts with this common grace kind of emphasis so that we can lead quiet lives and peaceable lives. But then if you keep reading, okay, so common grace, if you keep reading, he then pivots and that's where he says, because it pleases God that for people to be saved, right? And so even there in this really quick turnaround of those verses, you see this dynamic of common grace serving redeeming grace. I I start that with the story of Joseph, who we haven't mentioned, but you know, another another example of, again, when I hear a, if I go to church on Sunday and the sermon is about Joseph, then yeah, I want it to be about the redemptive historical narrative. I want it to be about forgiveness. Absolutely. However, for the Christian public administrator, I want them to see Joseph as this like proto public administrator. You know, his work as a public administrator was phenomenal. I mean, this work that he did to store up grain so much that he gave up trying to count it, trying to measure it. And then the system he came out with for rationing it out. And then when people couldn't, to both Egyptians and to the surrounding nations, and then when people couldn't afford it, he had this other system for where they could sell their land and then buy and then rent it back. And, you know, he had this very elaborate system. It was quite an administrative feat. And so there you see this proto-public administrator who God puts in place to administer his grace to the Egyptians and to the surrounding nations, people who do not worship him, people who were not going to thank the one true God. He used this government official and Joseph, the number two guy in Egypt, to administer his grace to those people. So there we see this role of government in administering God's common grace. But then we also see how this serves redeeming grace, right? That God also used this to sustain his people, to grow his people into this you know, this vast nation, to keep his promises that a Messiah would come out of the line of Judah, to sustain that line. I love that example that you see there in Joseph of serving common grace, but common grace then serving redeeming grace. And you see this all throughout the New Testament. One of my favorite exercises in writing this book was to read through the book of Acts just with this question in mind. And there you saw, it's just like, I gave a list of like all these bullet points.
I loved it.
Like, look at all these instances where basically government officials who themselves are obviously not Christians, these pagan government officials just doing their jobs, you know, maintaining peace, insisting on due process, educating citizens on how to file complaints, just doing their jobs, they were enabling the spread of the gospel and the growth of the early church. Obviously, this is not their intention, but God put them in place in many instances to preserve order, to preserve justice, and that provided this avenue for the growth of God's kingdom.
No, that was great. I loved, you rattled off a bunch of verses in that section. I appreciated that. And back to the whole, you know, Joseph, and you want the historical narrative, historical redemptive narrative approach to that. And of course, he's a type of Christ, and we get that. But the last episode, or actually two episodes I did a week and a half ago, I entitled it Reformed Snobbery, Reformed Joy Robbins Snobbery.
Yes, yeah.
I don't know if you listened to it, but I addressed.
I did, yeah.
Okay. I addressed that, you know, the Dare to Be a Daniel, the Slay Your Giants. Like, there's been such a reaction to moralistic preaching, which I'm thoroughly against, obviously. But what it's done is then it's totally made all these passages typological of Christ. And you can only apply the you're a wretched sinner who's going to fail parts of things. And you're not allowed to, like, grasp on to, like, this is Spirit-empowered life of a believer that you are called to live too. You're not going to be Daniel or David. You're going to be Chris and I'm going to be George. And the Lord is calling us to, you know, to live these things out. And there's absolutely is still principles in those things in as much as we do them by faith and in the Spirit. And so, I have a little sort of draw my bang. I try to reclaim, because the Bible tells us these are examples to us.
Yeah.
They're not simply just, you can't do it. You need a David or a Daniel, which is really Jesus, to do it for you. No, we can really actually do things that because we have Christ in us.
Right. Yeah. Which you knew was a big landing point for me as well was, you know, in talking about the experience of the three guys in the furnace, it's awesome to see, you know, the pre-incarnate Christ there with them, this theophany there in the furnace with them, and that it's amazing, obviously, right? But you know, something else I would want the Christian public administrator to know is that those three guys, they would be amazed to know that we have the Holy Spirit indwelling us now. You know, yeah, it's awesome to think that you've had this, that you had God there incarnate there in the furnace beside you for a while. But we have the Holy Spirit indwelling us all the time. We are his temple everywhere we go.
Yeah, we have that that knowledge, yeah, for sure, and the reality. So both the reality and the knowledge of it, it should empower us, absolutely. Well, just in wrapping up, usually I run a Birmingham Theological Seminary ad. I'll just do a plug because it really does apply to this whole conversation. BTS is very much interested in these kinds of conversations, and they have whole programs that are tailored to them. I mean, they do have an education program. If you're an educator in schools, they have psychology programs, but huge and big on pastoral ministry and on tailored programs. So their doctor of ministry program, like the one I'm in that I should finish, God willing, next year, pray for me, it's a demon in apologetics, but it's really public theology. And they just started a new one in chaplaincy, which is honestly exploding. And I'll be having an episode here with Colonel Pete Sniffen, who's over that program, as well as Jim Carter, who is with MNA for the chaplain group in the PCA, because there's actually hundreds of chaplains in the PCA ministering to people in, you know, usually mostly military spaces, but in the government. Like, that's kind of the work that I do with Ministry of State. And so BTS.education, if you want a certificate program, a master's degree, or you already have that and you're looking for a doctorate, there's just such great programs there. Chris, so good to talk to you, brother. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, great
thoughts
to talk to you.
Okay. Well, good deal.
All right. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's fun to talk about this stuff with you.
Yes. Oh, wait. We got to mention your website and how to get the book. So you do offer it for free on your site.
Yeah, so it's available for free. And that's at chrishorne.net. So chrishorne, HORNE.net. So it can be read there for free. And if you're in the market for a research methods textbook, that's also where you'll find that. And then the hard copy is on Amazon, so it's easy enough to find there. Bureaucrats in Babylon.
Is it a hardcover or it's paperback?
It's a hard copy, but no, it's a paperback, yeah.
Yes, yes. Okay. One thing I really liked about the structure of this short book, again, it's only about 90 pages, but was at the end of every chapter, you have those questions, typical, like, you know, these are small group reflections. They were really good. And I'm thinking of even trying to use them as I'm developing relationships in the Capitol as a study with a group who wants to do it.
That's the idea. Great.
Yeah. But the other thing was phenomenal suggested reading lists at the end of every chapter. So you had these questions, but then you also had like further reading. And that's where, again, I saw everything from Kuyper to Van Drunen to
Frame's Heller critique to, of Van Drunen.
Frame's critique. I saw that. The Escondido theology was in there. Good stuff, man.
And Bible verses. If you, the heading of those is something like Bible verses every public administrator should know in context.
Very good.
So please, you know, to the Christian public administrator reading this, do study those passages, but study the whole passage.
Yeah, so check it out. Check the free version out. And I will tell you, it's a real pain and very frustrating because you can't do anything with it but read it. And I like to mark my books up. So I had to like type out, you can't even copy out of it. I had to type out my notes.
Yeah.
But as I've already told.
That's a little gentle nudge toward.
Yes.
Buy
the book. It's $5. Come on. And I'm going to be buying it. I'm going to be giving these out in the government, and I'm buying them in bulk. So thanks again, Chris.
Great. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah.